My name is Charles Lutz. I work for the American Lutheran Church Office of Church and Society for about 6 more months until the end of this year when the ALC as a separate body ceases to exist. One of the issues that we've worked on in our office over the last years has been beginning of life biomedical ethics. A whole set of concerns about the ethical implications of what new technologies make possible at the beginning of human life. And we're going to look at 3 of those today that specifically have to do with fertility. With me is Katie Kraus from Spokane right here, who is a nurse practitioner. And she works, I don't know if it's exclusively, but heavily in the area of fertility and couples. And she'll be talking a little bit about her practical experience with couples and the counseling that is done and the kinds of things she does herself, literally, that will be part of what we're going to be talking about here theoretically. And I want to provide a little bit of a theoretical overview of the ethical questions that are involved with procreation technologies that are available to us today. And so we've titled this session, New Ways of Making Babies, The Ethics of Procreation Technologies. Biomedical ethics overall is a rapidly expanding field, as you perhaps are aware. Medical professionals and lay people alike are seeking guidance from wherever they can get it, including from biblical theologians and Christian ethicists, for working through the ethical implications of what new technologies make possible in the medical field. At the beginning of life, at the end of life, such questions as, to put it crassly, when do you pull the plug? That has been keeping people, a person alive by extraordinary means? When do you decide to discontinue extraordinary means of life sustenance? And also issues that come up during a lifetime. Some of those are, for example, how do we use as a society limited resources and for whom? And who should pay for the very expensive things that are possible in organ transplants or unusual ways of keeping one alive during the middle of a normal lifetime? Who should pay for that? How do you make the economic judgments as a society about all of that? Well, those are all going to be with us for, I suppose, as long as any of us are alive. This discussion this morning treats one part of the beginning of life issues, the ethics of new technologies for reproduction, for human reproduction. Now, there's a set of 7 of these beginning of life issues that are examined in a series of studies prepared by the 3 Uniting Lutheran Churches. These appeared about a year ago. And I'm going to ask Katie to send around a set of the 3 that we're looking at today. There are 4 more, a total of 7. And the other 4 are listed on the back of each of the pamphlets. There probably will be enough of these to go around if every couple of you take, if you are here as couples, if every couple takes one. The other 4 that we're not going to look at today, I'll just note for the sake of listeners to the tape: genetic screening and counseling, the ethics of prenatal diagnosis, the non-treatment of seriously handicapped newborns, that is, at what point and with what kinds of ethical considerations should one, parents, medical people, decide not to sustain a life that is severely damaged at birth? When do you apply extraordinary means and when do you not? And the final issue is genetic manipulation, genetic engineering, it's sometimes called. Those 4 we're not going to look at today. What we're going to look at today are artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, and surrogate mothering. These are all related to infertility and new technologies that are not only available, but very much being practiced. Now, since all of these technologies or methodologies were not known in biblical times, there is no direct biblical word that we can apply. We can't turn to a certain part of the Bible and find an answer. But there are general principles in the scriptures about the meaning of human life and of the marriage commitment, which we know as monogamy, and those general principles, I think, can help us. Let me read just one little section from Paul Gersild. Paul is a social ethicist and theologian teaching at Lutheran Southern Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina, and Paul was the one who wrote the pamphlet on in vitro fertilization. This is what he says about the theological considerations. What help can we receive from the Bible on this subject? While the Bible is authoritative for us, we must be careful how we understand that authority. For example, some Christians believe that every social issue can be resolved by referring to appropriate Bible verses. Unfortunately, this often results in an irresponsible use of Scripture. The world of advanced medical technology raises issues which the biblical writers never addressed, nor even imagined. Scripture is important in providing us with a variety of moral paradigms and a basic moral orientation as we address issues of this kind. But even here, Christians will disagree over what specific principles one should infer from the biblical witness. There are those who find scriptural support for the idea of a, quote, natural order, unquote. That is, divine sanction of the natural way in which procreation occurs, and that it should not be subverted by such procedures as in vitro fertilization. I'll insert here parenthetically that you often hear Roman Catholic theologians talking about the natural law and the natural order and not interfering with that if we would obey the will of God. And they even apply that to such things as contraception. And you're all familiar with that, I think, the Catholic position on that. Jersild goes on, there is a divine wisdom in linking the loving embrace of husband and wife with the act of procreation. So he's affirming that. Anything that threatens this unity of love and life threatens to undo a God-given order. Others, now he's still there quoting, I think, from the natural order theologians. Others, he says, maintain that the scriptures do not testify to a God who is the master designer of a static order, but to a God of history who continually summons human beings to be co-workers in fashioning a more humane order. If medical science and technology enable childless couples to realize the blessings of parenthood, we should rejoice that such advances are possible and recognize that we are fulfilling our God-given role in gaining dominion over the world, Genesis 1:28. Well, there's more along that line in each of these pamphlets that you can read at your own leisure. So, we can speak, in a sense, of new ways of making babies. The use of human egg and sperm, that remains constant. There's nothing new in that sense. But how they are united to create human life, the method by which they come together to create new life, that is extraordinary and relatively new and to some people very questionable, though it is obviously feasible scientifically. It probably is another area where we are aware that our science moves often more quickly than our ethical ability to cope with science and with what science develops. The concern for us today, this morning, I think begins with the pain of the childless couple who wish to have a child that is biologically their own. They're not satisfied to adopt. They're not satisfied to go through life childless if they can find any way of avoiding childlessness. They would prefer, I think, in every case, if possible, to have a child that is biologically related to both of them. But if that's not possible, there are couples today who say, at least let us have a child biologically related to one of us. And there are technologies in both of those categories that are available. Now, I've tried to chart on the board here behind me the present there are more than four possibilities, I expect, but four that we'll talk about this morning. And what I've suggested on the board is that within the circle, there is a couple, a woman and a man. There are two options that are within the circle because they involve only those two persons. There are two other options that involve a third party. One, a surrogate father, and the other, a surrogate mother. Okay? I think it's pretty obvious what the chart is trying to suggest. Most people, it seems to me, have no ethical problem with this. Some do, but most do not. Many people have ethical considerations that they raise or questions that they raise with the other two, with using a third party. So that perhaps is where we'll spend most of our time in discussion. The situation today, according to the figures I've seen, Katie, I don't know if your figures would agree with this or not, the situation is that 10 to 15% of U.S. marriages are barren. that is, for one reason or another, about 1 in 10 to 1 in 7 of U.S. married couples cannot have children by normal means. The largest single cause, according to what I've read, is male infertility. The sperm count is inadequate for some reason or another. There is not enough adequate sperm in the normal ejaculate to produce a conception with an egg. That's about 40% of all the cases. About 40% of all the cases, and the largest single factor. Now, AIH is artificial insemination by husband. That's within the circle in the design that I've put on the board. That is used when, for physical or psychological reasons, insemination via intercourse is problematic, or when, because of deficient sperm count, the sperm from several ejaculates is needed in order to make up a sufficient quantity to make conception statistically likely. There are few legal or social or ethical problems for most people with AIH, I think. Katie will talk a little bit about that later. Secondly, in vitro fertilization, which is also within the circle, but that is conception literally in glass. That's within what is often called a test tube. It's more often, I think, a dish. But some of you who've read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World may recall that in Brave New World, the standard way of procreation was in vitro, in test tube. When the mother's fallopian tubes are blocked or diseased or the husband's sperm is abnormal and can inseminate only in a controlled environment, this may be the technique that is used. Okay, some ethical considerations about that. Does it dehumanize procreation? Does it make it too mechanical, too non-natural? Or what of the destruction of potential new life whenever an embryo is destroyed and not implanted in a womb? Because in this technique, eggs are removed from the potential mother and not all of them are used. Okay, some would call that an abortion. That's wrong, morally wrong. Freeze storing of eggs in particular is problematic for some people, ethically problematic. It's akin to freeze storing of sperm, which is problematic for people. And another question, are we enough aware of the abnormalities of the child that may result? Do we have enough experience yet? Well, the fact is we don't have all that much experience yet, statistically. Let's go now to AID, which uses a third party. Yes?
Also under in vitro, tremendous cost.
Okay. It's economically skewed toward a certain class then, if they have to pay it themselves. Would not be available to the poor, most likely. Okay? AID, of course, is artificial insemination by donor. The technology is the same as with AIH. But the donor is not the husband of the woman who will conceive. It uses a surrogate father for the couple, usually anonymous. I believe that's still the case, usually out of a sperm bank. Ethical questions related to this technology. What is the nature of the marriage bond? And what does the use of a third party, even if anonymous, and even if no direct involvement in the sex act, what does that say about the nature of the marriage bond? Or a related question, how does the marriage covenant between two people relate to procreation? Is it a different reality when a third party's sperm is introduced? Well, Roman Catholic and many Protestant ethicists alike view AID as not acceptable because of the kinds of concerns I've just listed. They say it departs from the natural design of the Creator. It is not what God had in mind or has in mind today for procreation. It produces a radical asymmetry, a non-symmetrical relationship for the two parents. Because obviously one of the parents, the mother, can say, biologically, you are my child. The father cannot say that. What does that do to the parent-child relationship? That's another kind of ethical consideration. I'm not trying to give answers today as much as I am raise questions. You can, I hope, sense that. Finally, surrogate mothering. Gotten a lot of press lately because of the case in New Jersey, which ended up in the courts, and I'm sure you've all read about that. many of the same issues obtain in surrogate mothering as in AID, which is surrogate fathering. But I think with the added psychological strain of 9 months or more of emotional involvement by a third party, the surrogate father who ejaculates into a whatever container and whose sperm is stored in a sperm bank and it's anonymous doesn't have very much emotional involvement. The surrogate mother who carries a child for 9 months obviously has a different reality, psychologically and emotionally. I haven't heard of any court cases yet where surrogate fathers have gone to court trying to get possession of the child. They probably don't even know which child it is. I think they do not know which child it is that is theirs. But surrogate mothering is quite a different reality. The biological mother, who can never be anonymous to the couple, and as far as she is concerned, to that child, that new child, is in a different situation. And the whole set of relationships is therefore different. Ethical questions, therefore. Does it distort procreation, especially for that surrogate mother who is being used as a vessel, but who, under the legal agreements that are normally signed, has no continuing relationship to that child and no continuing responsibility for it? Is that different from normal adoption, which has some similarities, obviously, because another mother and father have borne a child for the couple who eventually adopt? Even today, the identity of the mother, at least in an adoptive situation, is knowable and known in many cases. I think there is still a difference. And that's my own judgment, but we can talk about that in a moment. That is, I think surrogate mothering is psychologically, emotionally, and probably theologically as well, different from giving a child for adoption. Because surrogate mothering is arranged in advance. It is pre-planned and becomes a legal contract. The final questions for believers on this entire subject of infertility and parenting, the final questions, I think, are these. And I want to end with that and then invite Katie to comment. First, does the end justify the means? If the end or goal is childbearing and child-rearing, having children, can any means be used to achieve that? Does anything go? Is anything legitimate, any kind of technology or methodology? That's one question that I think is basic to all of these methods. Secondly, to what extent is procreation a natural process that is integral to human identity? That is, how much departure from the natural one man, one woman intercourse, impregnating an egg with the man's sperm, the normal way we think of in procreation, how much departure from that is allowable before you start to depart from or undermine or subvert human identity itself? I don't know where that line should be drawn, but my sense is there is a line somewhere that each of us would draw. Third question, why do we want children anyway? Maybe that's... Maybe that's the basic one and the first one or the last one, but it seems to me that Christians and people of the Bible, I think Jews would agree with us in this, want children in a theological sense because we believe in God's promises and have hope in God for the future. It's when people don't have hope for the future that they start to wonder if they should have children. And I've heard some couples today say that. In a nuclear age, should we even want to have children? Is there a future? It seems to me that a biblical people want to have children, among all the other reasons that are common to human beings, because of God's promises about the future. And we believe that there is a future in God. Parenting, then, in that kind of view, becomes essentially a stewardship that we are given by God. It is a stewarding responsibility that God gives to us. If that is so, I think the essence of parenting is child-rearing, not child-bearing, which would suggest that the children we rear as a stewardship under God do not necessarily have to be the children that we biologically bear. And I think most adoptive couples see it that way. There are children who need parenting. Why not us? And some parents who have their own biological children also adopt. For that basic reason, because there is a need for children to be loved and cared for and brought to maturity. A final question that I raise in this connection is, and it's tied, I think, to the why do we want children anyway, a final question is, do we view childlessness as failure, as incompleteness? That is the inability to have one's own biological children a mark of human failure? Do we view it that way? Should we view it that way? Does God view it that way? My answer to that would be no, but it's easy for me to say because I have, and my wife, Hertha, and I have three children of our own, biological children. If we were childless, biologically childless, I don't know how I would answer that. I would hope that we would answer it that no, childlessness is not a sign of failure as a human being or as an incompleteness as a human being. But I suspect many couples who face biological childlessness at least view it as incompleteness. They want to be complete, and for them the way to completeness is to have their own children biologically, not adoption. Adoption for them might be a poor second. Well, I've run through a lot of stuff very quickly. I apologize for that, but I do want to save a lot of time for our discussion about this because we all, I think, have opinions about it. So let's share that, and I'd like to ask that we begin it by inviting Katie Krause, who is a nurse practitioner in Spokane who works very much with all of this technology in her own vocation under God. I'd like to ask her to start the discussion. Why don't you come and sit here so it'll be picked up easily on the tape?
Well, first of all, I want to start by saying that last year I took part in a discussion of the same sort at Holden Village and was introduced to these pamphlets, and they have become a part of our practice in Spokane, because anyone who comes to us and has a problem with infertility, before we even address the situation, we give them one of these pamphlets that would pertain to their problem. Because we feel that questions, as Chuck said, need to be raised. One of the people that I work with, though, does not want me to give these pamphlets to the people because he's worried about the questions that will be raised. And as I said to him, you and I need to sit down and talk about this a little more. And that's one of the things that I'm going to make sure that I do when I get back to Spokane.
Say more about that. Why does this person not want the
pamphlets? That's what I want to know. So that's why I have to ask him.
Is it a commercial reason?
No. No, I'm not sure. I want to know that. So, I think that probably what I will address, rather than the technical how of all of these things, is the major issue for me, and that is the emotional impact of infertility upon a couple. My heart just aches for people who are unable to have children and who feel that it is very important for them to have their own biological children, because it actually becomes an obsession. Their whole life revolves around when they are going to ovulate, when their fertile time is, and then you lose all pleasure in sharing in your marriage. It's just unbelievable.
And it's your whole existence.
Your whole existence, sexually measuring things. I even find myself, when I get a phone call from one of the people who has an infertility problem, thinking, oh my God, I don't know if I can answer their questions, and almost wanting to avoid them. And so this is the major issue. The cost for the artificial insemination when it's the husband's sperm that's provided is a great cost emotionally, but it isn't as great a cost financially. But it is extremely difficult for the male, because very often, as Chuck said, they have a very low sperm count. So before they even come to see us, they have to trot their semen to another place to have a special procedure done to concentrate the sperm. And of course, you have to go through all of this planning in order to get to this place at the right time for the fertile time for the female, and then come to see me or one of the physicians, and then we do this procedure of direct intrauterine insemination. What I generally do is encourage the husband to be there when the procedure is done. And usually they will
observe it,
and usually they will hold hands, and very often if they're Christians, they will pray together, and I make sure that I encourage this, that if I know that they are practicing Christians or whatever their faith is, I encourage them to be in prayer at the time that this procedure takes place.
Do the men relate a low sperm count to feelings about masculinity?
Yes, they really do. It's very, very common. What I generally do is we do have some counselors in the area that are very good at working with infertility people. And I generally encourage them to not only receive what counseling that we can provide in the office, but that they seek counseling elsewhere too. There are some pastors too who have made themselves available for counseling. So, then when you get on to artificial insemination donor, I have a problem with that myself. I have not worked that one out as far as my Christian faith and exactly how I feel about that one. And we do have a particular counselor who helps the couples with that. But what I have finally done is if it is a time in the cycle where the people, it has to be done, and I'm there and there's no one else to do it, then I go ahead and do it and say a prayer ahead of time.
Through your,
Is it
a clinic?
Well, what it is it's four obstetricians and gynecologists who practice together, and I work with them or work for them. And so at times, they might have a client that needs to have the artificial insemination donor. And they will be doing surgery. And I am there. And so I will go ahead and do the procedure. Now, how you get the donor's semen is we work through a semen bank in California. And there is a list of donors, not by name, but by Scandinavian, 6 feet tall.
They do keep ethnic background.
Oh, ethnic background, education. Want to know what the education? PhD in theology, you know. And so the clients get a list of who's available, and then they choose.
Are they all Californians?
I think so, yes.
So all of these babies come from Spokane, by AID, are fathered by Californians.
Fathered by Californians, yes. And so I'll get on to the next situation, which is artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization. That one, I still haven't made up my mind ethically about that one either. I'm where everyone else is. But the thing that I object to, I think probably the most with the in vitro fertilization, is the cost. Let me back up. Our clinic is a satellite clinic for the University of Washington in vitro fertilization program. And so what we do is we prepare the couple for the actual procedure. We give them the drugs, which cost a great deal of money, to stimulate, to what actually happens is the overstimulation of the ovary. And then we order the blood tests that need to be done, and we also have the ultrasounds that are done to check and make sure that the ovaries are producing these multiple eggs. And then when everything is right, they make a quick trip over to Seattle. But the thing that concerns me the most is, as you brought up, the cost is extremely high. The cheapest is $3,000. It's more likely $5,000. And the last I heard, the success rate of a pregnancy from in vitro fertilization is just above 20%.
Katie, would you describe what is done, what the method involves?
I have not seen it done, because it's all I know is what we do in our office. But they have to, using laparoscopy, and I think they have another method, but retrieve the eggs, where you take a tube and you make a little incision in the abdomen, or two incisions, one that you use to see what you're doing, and then the other is the actual retrieval. And as you said, several eggs are retrieved, and then they freeze some of them, and then I would assume that after you have an ovum, then I don't know how long it takes before they put that back into the uterus.
But they fertilize it in
mm-hmm.
the dish.
Mm-hmm. In the dish. I haven't seen it. But. And I would assume that the implantation of the fertilized ovum is done the same way that the direct intrauterine insemination is done. And when we do that, we use, of all things, a Tomcat catheter. or a very small feeding tube for premature babies. So, and that is attached to a syringe and put into the cervical canal and up into the uterus.
Now, there's a variation on what I put on the board that is also technologically available now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's being done. And that's to use eggs from anonymous donors.
I don't know about that.
We had a doctor here a year ago who talked about it. He's mm-hmm. at Mayo in Rochester. Mm-hmm. He said they're working on that, and it is scientifically feasible.
Right.
Now. It's the counterpart to AID,
mm-hmm.
where the egg donor, the woman, is anonymous,
mm-hmm.
and the sperm is that of the couple, the husband, and the I think the mother of the couple, the potential mother of the couple, will carry the implanted
yes.
egg, fertilized egg mm-hmm. to term, and
mm-hmm.
so it's another variation. You want to say anything about surrogate mothering?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we have never had a surrogate mother in our practice.
Have you had people asking about it?
We've had people asking about it. But I am currently reading a book that I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but it's called The Secret Life of the Unborn Child. It's just wonderful. Are you familiar with this? And it's written by a psychiatrist in Canada, and his specialty is perinatal psychiatry. And what that means is the study of the emotional life in utero, of the baby in utero. And he has brought out some things that are really striking, that babies are in utero are very capable of learning long before we would even believe it. I'll tell you one little anecdote that he includes in this book that I just found to be fascinating. The conductor of the Toronto Symphony, his mother was a musician, a cellist, and when he was in his early part of his career, he was going over a score, and it was an unfamiliar score to him, and he every time he would come to the bottom of a page, he knew what the notes would be before he even turned the page. And so he went and he talked to his mother. And she said, "Oh, yes, that was one part of my repertoire when I was carrying you." And I thought, my goodness, that is really uncanny. And he has many more anecdotes to that effect. So it is becoming very clear that it is extremely important, the emotional life of the mother while she's carrying her baby. And it doesn't mean that if you get angry once in a while or if you're sad that that's going to traumatize your baby. But if you live in a constant state of anxiety, or if for some reason you divorce yourself emotionally from your unborn child, it can have an adverse effect on their whole life, how they will be after they're born, how they see the world.
And that's what the surrogate mother needs to do for her own mental health.
Right, for her own mental health. So it, I really do question whether or not a surrogate mother would be good for the emotional health of an unborn child.
If she kept the child,
it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. She might have bonded with that child while it was in utero, and then couldn't give it up. And
there are couples, I'm sure you run into them, who insist that they have to be fulfilled, if possible, bear their own biological children, or at least the child of one of them. And what do you say to them? You must counsel adoption first, do mm-hmm. you?
Yeah, we do.
And, you know, sure. Why isn't that acceptable to them?
Well, very, very often, they don't know why. And one has to encourage them to try and explore why. I know of one instance when the in vitro program was first started at the University of Washington. There was a couple that desperately wanted children, and they went through in vitro fertilization, and the woman did conceive, and they found out that they were going to have twins, and they said, "We want one of them aborted because we don't want twins."
Oh my. Oh my.
Yeah. And that's when they decided they've got to do a better job of counseling than they had done.
They really had everything pre-programmed, didn't
uh-huh.
they?
They had everything.
Had to come out just right.
Uh-huh. And no, I mean, that's...
What was the answer to them when they said, "We want one aborted"?
That was no.
Wouldn't do it.
No way.
Did they accept the twins? And are they raising them?
They're divorced. And then you have another legal question, I would think, about the care of children who are born under these circumstances. Are you a lawyer? Okay.
I participated in a panel discussion, I think, last fall with physicians and clinicians mm-hmm. on this very issue. And it was fascinating, not only doing the background research, but let me tell you, this is an area that is so involved and so complex.
It is.
I think the Southern Pamphlet has done an excellent job in fostering further discussion.
Yes.
But we haven't scratched the surface.
But they raise questions more than they provide answers, mm-hmm. which is the nature of most ethical.
There is an organization, I'm trying to remember the name, but I think something like Physicians for Social Responsibility mm-hmm. or something like that are addressing some of the issues, which I found really helpful. Because one of my sense coming out of that day-long conference last fall was there were many physicians, and in all due respect to physicians, who were saying, "If it's possible to do it, let's do it."
Yeah.
And I think that's a dimension that we, whether we be physicians or Christians or clergy persons, I guess that's a terrible distinction to make, need to enter that way of discussion. Because just because it is possible to do it doesn't necessarily mean you should do it.
but it's part of the scientific mindset of our time. When if you can build, it's medically equivalent, I guess, if you can build a supersonic transport, you ought to do it, no matter what the cost, environmentally, economically. I think there is that. I don't know. There must be some medical people who attack that idea, though, and say, no, we should not do everything.
Well, that's where that organization comes in, the social responsibility.
Well, we are most fortunate in Spokane. Sacred Heart Hospital has a Christian ethicist, and we can call on this person whenever we have dilemmas that we really need help with.
That's a staff position, so identified?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, an ethicist from a Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Is there always also a Jewish ethicist available?
No.
No?
No. Not at Sacred
Heart. Not at Sacred Heart.
And I suppose if we wanted to address this problem from a Jewish perspective, we could call the rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to pose you a question. This was something that was asked me, and I would like to know what you would do in this situation. A young unmarried woman in her 30s, so coming to the end of her biological clock, you've read about that, who was
at least the optimum time.
The optimum time. Who wanted to have children, who had a bit of an infertility problem, who had a sexual partner who assumed that she was sterile, wanted to have a child by this person, but did not want him to know, and wanted me to give her the drug that would stimulate her ovaries to produce ovum.
And then to use which method? In vitro?
No, just to give her the drug.
Oh, okay.
That's all. What would you do?
Send her over to Seattle.
Did she indicate why she did not want him to know that he would be the father?
That she felt that it was her right to have a baby, and that she did not want him involved in it in any way other than providing the sperm
to be an anonymous donor to himself, but not to her.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, she didn't want him also to feel any kind of ongoing responsibility
or any commitment,
for the child,
yes.
Because maybe she wouldn't have an ongoing commitment to him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, that's happened by accident.
Mm-hmm. Right, by accident. By accident.
Let me ask in direct response to that the question that I wanted to close with anyway. We've got about 5 minutes left. But what is the responsibility of the church in the midst of all this, in the preaching and teaching we do about family, parenting, marriage, childbearing, childrearing, etc.? What is the church's responsibility, and where are we not perhaps fulfilling what we ought to be under God? What ought we be doing differently or saying differently, if anything? Any of you have thoughts on that?
We have posed another question to
the sure.
lady that said she has the moral right to do what she said. What if you had a drug that can cure a person from cancer or may kill them because it's too strong for their body? And the person comes in and says, let me have the drug to try because any way there's a possibility to cure cancer, I would like an opportunity. Are you going to say no to that person? My concern is when somebody starts inflicting their moral and their choice on someone else, I don't think you can do that on medical technology.
Okay, I'd like to speak to that. And the question that you posed, because I think what the church doesn't teach enough about is the contrast of the individualism ethic of the United States. We have the rugged individualism of the frontier and the community barn-building ethic that are really built into our culture. And rugged individualism has risen so high that the community aspect has nearly disappeared. We don't have communities much in the United States, anywhere, at any level, among any kinds of groups. And the communities that we do have tend, by and large, to be very competitive communities. I found that at seminary, for example.
In that community.
And what I hear you saying, sir, is really, it's the woman's decision, and that ends the discussion ethically. I'm sorry, I think there's more to it, that a woman's decision has to be made in the context of a community.
Well,
and the church doesn't say
not
that.
The woman's right. It's the individual's right to use medical technology to their advantage.
Okay, and what I'm saying is that the church has a responsibility to speak to individual needs, desires, wants, and possibilities, and to the community's needs, desires, wants, and possibilities, and to maintain the tension, because there's never, often, there is not a place where ambiguity disappears. We have too much ambiguity in it. It's always a tension. When you leave one or the other out, you're in trouble.
You're saying you cannot allow, in a society that wants to be responsible, to have individual decisions alone determining
right.
everything
right.
without regard to
right.
social costs
right.
or social implications. And I think that includes economic costs.
Everything.
If you're rich enough to be able to do it, does that make it okay? And to hell with those who can't afford it. That's their problem.
I don't think
that's good enough. And that's not only here, but in the whole of medical possibilities today, of course. Any last comments on the church's role?
That it's against the laws of nature. What is more,
do they oppose AIH? I don't think they oppose AIH.
Yes.
They also oppose that?
What is interesting from the free choice point of view that we need to look at here is that demographically we find that abortions do not result when the pill or the condom or whatever you're using is available. It occurs when children are a liability. That's usually under high urbanization. Therefore, high abortion rates are a reflection people who can no longer take care of kids. And that's why the Catholics object to that. That means the society in which you're living is determining your free choice, and it is an evil society. So we need to look at that, and that gets back to her issue. So what we're calling free choice is essentially the same thing that we call consumerism. We are subject to ads on television because we don't have anybody to tell us that they're better alternatives, and the church needs to fill that role.
We have time for one more.
I think the church
understands so you can be seen and heard on the mic.
I think the new church needs to be very, very active and being very bold and needs to discuss in this kind of realm at very early ages to very old grandparent ages. So we are with the realities both from a religious and spiritual standpoint and from a medical.
We probably should have this conversation with our minors this weekend. Maybe even with the kids in our
bathroom.
Thank you all very much. Thanks to you, Katie.